From Louisiana to California, North Dakota to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, in a rare display of bipartisan unity, Congress is acting on sweeping legislation to reform the nation's criminal justice system. Jordan Richardson from the Charles Koch Institute is here with details. Congress has punted the budget into the new year, and President Trump's last best effort to get funding for the border wall has failed. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Is imposing tariffs on imported steel by presidential order executive overreach? A new lawsuit contends it is. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the arguments. And have frequent deployments and the 17-year-long war in Afghanistan stretched the U.S. military too thin? Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, answers that question on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Perhaps it was the spirit of the Christmas season, but lawmakers and public policy groups from across the ideological spectrum came together in support of landmark changes to the nation's criminal justice system, designed to help more offenders become productive members of society. Here to discuss the changes is Jordan Richardson. Jordan is a senior policy analyst at the Charles Koch Institute. Jordan, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jordan, when we talk about criminal justice reform, a fairly broad category and some very significant developments here in the last few days. But before we go into the specifics of what has occurred, tell us a little bit about the issue and why is criminal justice reform so important?
Well, I think one of the main things to keep in mind about criminal justice reform is that we've seen a massive growth in our prison system over the past 30 to 40 years. So when Ronald Reagan was president in 1980, the federal prison population was about 25,000 people. Today, it's hovering around 200,000 people. In 1980, when Reagan was president, in all the states combined, there were about 500,000 prisoners. And today, that number is closer to 2 million across the states. And so what we've seen is that we've had a huge reliance on passing more laws that criminalize more behavior, putting people in jail for longer amounts of time. And as such, we've grown the prison system that we are now the highest incarcerated nation in the entire world. We now spend about $80 billion every single year to maintain this system. And the reason that this is concerning, number one, is that's a huge problem when you have these overcrowded prisons. It's not safe for prisoners or the guards who patrol them. But more importantly is that with every single person who goes behind bars, we know that at some point they're going to be released from prison eventually. 95% of everyone who goes behind bars will at some point be returning back to society. And with so many people having a criminal record and going through the system there, we want to make sure that they're actually set up for success and they don't reoffend and go back to prison over and over again, costing us more in public safety and in dollars. And so what we care about when we talk about reform in the criminal justice system is twofold. First, we want to address the number of people who are going into prison. We think there are a lot of laws that unnecessarily put people behind prison bars for too long. But also, we don't do a very good job of making sure that once they're released from prison, that they have a successful return back to society because they're branded for life as a criminal, and they don't really have a lot of chances to get back and to start a job, start a family, or a business. So criminal justice reform with the front end of sentencing, but also the back end of what happens once you're released from prison. So that's kind of the issue that conservatives and liberals and libertarians and all, people from all different political stripes are talking about when they mean criminal justice reform.
And Jordan, let's pick up on that thought for just a few minutes here. You have described groups from across the ideological spectrum, and we all know that this country is very deeply divided. There's a hard right, a hard left. This issue, however, has brought everybody together. What is it about it that the left, the right, Republicans, Democrats, libertarians, everyone agrees that we had to undertake these reforms?
Well, it's a bipartisan issue now because it was a bipartisan issue that got us in this mess to begin with. So if you go back and you look at all the bills that increased the penalties for time served in prison and made it harder for people to return to society after serving time in prison, it was Republicans and Democrats who did it. it was something that we both parties agreed that it was a good thing to do back then. But experience and wisdom has shown that it was a little bit of an overkill. It's solving a problem of by using a hammer to kill an ant. Yes, you killed the ant, but you caused a whole lot more damage to the surrounding areas. The reason I think you're seeing that both parties are embracing reform today is because they recognize that beyond the cost of prison and beyond the public safety concerns, this is a matter about human dignity. We actually care about these people that are our neighbors and our friends who go into prison. If they run into the law and they run afoul of the law, at some point they're going to become back to society. They're going to live with us again, and we want to be able to make sure they're set up for success. And criminal justice reform is something that both the left and the right can agree on, because it is about human dignity, and it's about realizing that at some point we have to give someone a second chance to make it back in this life.
Another unique factor about this issue is the fact that Congress is actually doing or has done something about it. There is specific legislation dubbed the First Step Act, which has cleared legislative hurdles. And as we look at that act, can you give us a little bit of detail as to what it is that the First Step Act includes?
The main thing that this bill is designed to do is to address, like I mentioned, there's the front-end reforms about sentencing, the number of people who go into prison, but also the back end, what people are doing once they're in prison and once they come out. What this legislation is designed to do is to allow judges to have more flexibility about who goes into prison. When people come before a judge, the judges are going to have better discretion if someone is a first-time nonviolent offender to make sure that they don't get the maximum certain penalties for these crimes. But also in the back end, it's using job training and education and preparing prisoners to realize that at some point they're going to be released, so they better start training right now. And it's a problem when you have people in prison who just 6 months before they're about to be released, then the prisons decide to say, well, let's start to get you ready to go out back into society. But you've spent 20 years in prison. It's a whole new world out there. You know, credit cards and the internet and things that you were not familiar with when you went into prison are now the norm. So it's the job of this act that is being considered is to be able to educate people and also give them an incentive that if you do anger management, if you do job training, if you do education about how to better yourself, then there's going to be an incentive to take time off your sentence where you can actually be released to home confinement sooner than you would before. It's something that I think is important to realize is, I mentioned that 95% of prisoners are going to be released at some point. That number is about 650,000 people per year. And that's an interesting number because whether we pass this bill or not, 650,000 people are going to be released onto our streets every single year. And we had better be making sure we've got the choice of we can have them educated and ready to train for jobs, or we can do nothing. This is really how we need to start thinking about these issues is we have people behind bars and we've got a choice about what happens to them once they're there. And it would be prudent from a cost savings, from a public safety concern, and also from a matter of human dignity to make sure that they're set up for success.
We have been talking with Jordan Richardson, who is a senior policy analyst at the Charles Koch Institute, and we've been talking about criminal justice reform, the recently passed First Step Act. And Jordan, tell us a little bit about the Charles Koch Institute, also where folks can go on the web to read more.
The Charles Koch Institute is a nonprofit educational organization. We don't take stances on legislation, but we seek to educate the public about areas where we believe that we can provide the most value to create human dignity across the board and remove obstacles for people's flourishing. You can visit us at cki.org and learn more about our work there.
Jordan Richardson of the Charles Koch Institute. Jordan, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, and we have some action or delayed action, delayed reaction in Congress on the budget. We're going to talk about that today. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, we had a budget deadline. There were threats by the president to shut the government down. In the end, what happened?
Yeah, it looks like the Congress is going to agree to a short-term CR or a continuing resolution, which basically means that they're not going to pass a budget. They're going to just keep government funding at the level that it's currently at, and that it's going to extend into the new year. What's troubling about this is that the Democrats, led by Pelosi, are going to be in charge of the House. So you're going to see an entirely different sort of debate occur once power switches over to the Democrats in the House. Now, Republicans and Democrats have been fighting over so many issues on so many things, but on the one thing that they seem to agree with, and that's more and more spending. So I think a budget will ultimately prevail early next year, but it's not going to be something that taxpayers like, and it's not going to be something that a lot of Trump supporters and conservatives like. So it's not good news.
President Trump, of course, Andy, had threatened a shutdown, a government shutdown, if he didn't get funding for the border wall. All of that collapsed. The president seemed to give in. Republicans in Congress apparently didn't have the votes. Does that mean that any opportunity, any chance to fund this wall is pretty much dead for the rest of Trump's first term?
Yeah, there's so many things about this issue and this debate that I would love to talk about, but it would probably last 3 hours. The thing that confronts us right now is that lame duck sessions of Congress are so dumb and they're so horrible because the members delay and delay and delay and procrastinate and put off big, big issues until after an election where there are a lot of members who are voting in the lame duck who won't have a job in January. So they are not good representatives to vote on these things. It's like firing somebody and then letting them continue to work in the office. So that's a bad idea. The second idea is that Trump has continually made the border wall a contentious issue. And I bet a lot of your listeners saw him and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer fight vocally in the Oval Office on national TV. And Trump basically said, "I will be responsible if the government shuts down." I actually thought that was refreshing. The liberal press and the Democrats continually demonize a shutdown as a horrible, awful, no good, very bad thing. And I think it is something, and this is controversial, I think it's something that might be necessary in order to unjar the polarization that's in D.C. I think it's very important that taxpayers recognize that a shutdown is not what the media claims it to be. It is not a total collapse of our government. It does not mean that we're not being properly defended on our borders and overseas. It does not mean that Social Security checks and health care aren't being covered. It just means that non-essential work is going to pause for a minute. And every time that we have these budget fights, and every time we get up to a brink of a shutdown, I think taxpayers are starting to recognize that shutdowns are not all that bad, and that they're not, the sky is falling. So I think if we continue to have these budget fights and these shutdowns keep occurring, I think that will work in taxpayers' benefit. Now, about the border wall specifically, Trump is getting into this ugly habit where he threatens a shutdown. He threatens that he wants the wall built, but then at the last moment he backs out. And it's not his own fault. It's Congress's inability to pay for the wall. All Democrats don't want to do it, and even some Republicans. So the votes simply aren't there. So it's a strategy that I think Trump is going to have to change going into the next year and the next budget fight.
Switching gears here, talking about the United States Senate now, we're going to have a new United States senator come the first of the year. How did that come about?
With the passing of John McCain, there was a vacancy in the Senate seat. Governor Ducey, I don't think, was prepared to name a long-term replacement for McCain at the time. So he made a very safe bet, and he appointed former Senator John Kyle to fill that seat. John Kyle himself said that he was not going to be there very long, and in fact, that has now become true. He said that he will resign from the Senate at the end of this year. So I don't remember when he started, but he basically was appointed for only a few months. So now there's a vacancy, and now Governor Ducey has appointed Congresswoman Martha McSally. She ran for Jeff Flake's Senate seat and lost to a Democrat. I would have thought that that would have ended her career. She's a very moderate Republican. I would argue that she's more moderate than Jeff Flake, especially on economic issues. But she seems to be the best choice that the governor had. I would argue with that, but that seems to be the case. And so she will now replace Kyle for John McCain's seat, and she will hold it through the 2020 elections. She will be forced, though, to run an official reelection campaign in the 2020 cycle. So that's where we stand. It's my hope that she will vote like a conservative because she has to deal with that election in 2020. But if past performance is any indication of future performance, I think taxpayers could be disappointed by her.
We will keep a close eye on that as we head into the 2020 cycle. But for now, we have been talking with Andy Roth of the Club for Growth. And Andy, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here, and a Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, Loman. Thanks for having me.
A federal lawsuit contending that President Trump exceeded his executive authority by imposing steel tariffs challenges the scope of presidential powers. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
President Donald Trump might be getting an unwelcome Christmas present from the U.S. Court of International Trade. That's the court of law that heard a major legal challenge this week to the president's steel tariffs, and it's the first significant legal challenge that seeks to overturn not just the tariffs, but rather the president's authority to impose these and other tariffs on supposedly national security grounds. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week, but allow me to be possibly the first, or depending on when you're listening to this, maybe the last, to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. As I said, big legal challenge this week in front of a somewhat obscure legal body, the U.S. Court of International Trade. It used to be known as the U.S. Customs Court. You may be more familiar with it under that name. They heard oral arguments on Wednesday morning in a lawsuit that challenges the constitutionality of the 1962 federal law used by President Donald Trump to impose his tariffs on steel and aluminum earlier this year. The lawsuit says that Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 should be found unconstitutional because the law lacks any intelligible principle limiting the president's authority to impose tariffs on supposedly national security grounds. The U.S. Constitution grants Congress the sole authority for setting trade policy, after all, and the lawsuit contends that the delegation of that authority to the president is allowed only in specific instances and not in the sweeping broad way that was authorized back in the 1960s by Section 232. So this gets a little bit complicated, but the terms of Section 232 say that presidents have the authority to impose tariffs for national security reasons. But lawyers involved in the case have told me that the restriction here, that national security definition, is insufficient, in part because the definition of what counts as national security has been stretched so wide, not just by this administration, but by presidents over the past few decades. So Trump invoked Section 232 back in March when he announced plans to impose that 25% tariff on imported steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum. The lawsuit in front of the court is only challenging the steel tariff, but if the court overturned Section 232, it would effectively kill both sets of tariffs. Those tariffs went into effect on June 1st. And even though the president has publicly offered a wide range of explanations for why he imposed the tariffs, he's gone so far as to say that he was trying to punish American trading partners for unfair practices, to even suggesting that it was just straight up protectionism for the American steel industry. But besides all that, or behind all of that, the legal rationale for the tariffs has remained the same. Per Section 232, they are a quote unquote national security matter. So the case in front of the court is asking to declare Section 232 unconstitutional because the power to tax and regulate foreign commerce is ultimately vested in the Constitution. That's what Gary Horlick, one of the attorneys working on the case for the American Institute of International Steel, a Virginia-based trade association that represents importers and other industries in the steel trade. That's what Gary Horlick told me about the case this week. He says that Congress may delegate aspects of that power to the executive branch, but only if there's a limiting principle on how to proceed. So only if it's very clear under what circumstances the president may use that authority. Regardless of the legal outcome, though, it's pretty obvious that the Trump administration's national security rationale for the tariffs is already pretty weak, and this was a focus of the oral arguments on Wednesday. It's an argument that's essentially built atop decades of congressional deference to presidential authority, combined with an equally longstanding effort to stretch the concept of what counts as America's national security to cover almost anything and everything, even if it's not really directly related to the defense or the Pentagon or the military at all. The tariffs are necessary because relying on imported steel and aluminum threatens to impair the national security, is what Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross argued in March when he first announced the tariffs. The theory there is that because American weapons of war depend on steel and aluminum supplies, domestic producers must be protected from international supplies that could be cut off in the event of a conflict. And that makes at least some degree of sense, but Judge Jerry Katzman on Wednesday noted that the White House had gone ahead with the steel tariffs even after Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said that there was very little need for steel or aluminum imports for national defense purposes. And the judge, during the oral arguments on Wednesday, said he was scratching his head a little bit about the rationality of a presidential action that ignores exactly what the president's own defense secretary said. Now, the lawyers for the Justice Department who are trying to defend the tariffs in this lawsuit, they are trying to essentially, throughout the oral arguments, they tried to distinguish between national defense in a very narrow sense, saying that the difference between the amount of steel and aluminum we might need to build missiles and bombs and weapons of war versus national defense in the sense of economic well-being as a broader aspect of national security. And this has been the point that the Trump administration has made over and over again, but it's a point that seems to generally ring hollow, even with Republicans in Congress, for example. Bob Corker, the Republican senator from Tennessee, has gone so far as to say that making claims regarding national security to justify what is inherently an economic question not only harms the very people we want to help and impairs relations with our allies, but also invites our competitors to retaliate. And Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania has called the national security rationale for the steel tariffs a false pretense. But Congress hasn't really done much, aside from saying some things, to actually stop the Trump administration's tariffs, and they seem more likely to just let the administration run this policy and let it take its course. So it seems as though the courts may be the best chance for opponents of the steel tariffs to get this rejected, and importantly, not just to knock down the Trump administration's steel tariffs, but also preventing future presidents from abusing the Section 232 powers to dictate trade policy, or from further expanding the definition of national security in order to shape the economy to their liking, which is something that most conservatives should disagree with. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Again, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year out there, and we will catch you again in 2019 right here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
America has been at war since September 11, 2001, and that extended period of action has taken a toll on our armed forces. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
September 11, 2001 marked the beginning of a protracted asymmetrical war with terrorist forces seeking the destruction of the United States and our way of life. In the almost 17 years since this war began, and in almost 30 years since Desert Storm, when our nation's reserve, National Guard, and active duty forces have served side by side in defending our nation, the strategic risk of our nation's approach to modern warfare must be questioned. There are two extraordinarily important strategic and operational issues at play. The first is the Abrams Doctrine, and the second is the all-volunteer force. These two strategic and operational objectives came up at a meeting that I was invited to at the White House concerning supporting veterans and military families. In the meeting, operational tempo, meaning how frequently military forces are being used and the impact on their families, was discussed. The Abrams Doctrine developed as a result of the Vietnam War. During the Vietnam conflict, the nation's National Guard and Reserve forces were seldom, if ever, called upon to serve in combat. The military draft was a constant part of our lives in the 1960s through 1969, when the draft was ended. The Abrams Doctrine was intended to save forces and utilize the Reserve National Guard components effectively. Prior to the Abrams Doctrine, it was not uncommon for the Reserve components to receive substandard equipment and training. In many cases, the active component did not believe the reserve component or National Guard to be viable. In an outstanding article by then Lieutenant Colonel Brian Jones of the U.S. Army War College, he stated, and I quote, "The layered total force policy, referred to informally as the Abrams Doctrine, has just exceeded 30 years as a fundamental aspect of the Department of Defense force structure and manning policy. The Abrams Doctrine was principally driven by force structure considerations and constraints that General Abrams faced in the post-Vietnam era. General Abrams' actual intention in advocating this policy was an attempt both to save force structure and to resource the reserve component forces appropriately," unquote. The second operational strategic issue of all the volunteer force actually complicates the Abrams Doctrine and may put the nation at risk in light of any prolonged conflict such as the present time with the war on terrorism. It was believed in the 1970s that due to reduced force requirements that a draft would no longer be needed. That belief was that there was such a large available pool of available and eligible potential service members that a draft would not be needed. In fact, the RAND Corporation in 2006 published an article describing the all-volunteer force as a success. This success was a measure of the time in which the report was published. In 2006, our nation was completing only the third full year of conflict in the war on terror. Fast forward to 2018, and the success of the all-volunteer force and the Abrams Doctrine must be reexamined in light of the duration of this conflict on terrorism and the range of military risks facing our nation today. For instance, studies have shown that less than 30% of eligible younger people would qualify for military service today. This shocking statistic, when combined with the far greater need to employ reserve and National Guard forces under the Abrams Doctrines, points to a disaster in the making for our nation should a full-scale conflict explode on the world scene. Recently, in my district in the Pennsylvania legislature, our 28th Division headquarters returned from an almost 12-month deployment to the Middle East. This deployment is one of hundreds that have taken place since 2001. It was noted in a recent research report that 2.7 million Americans have served on deployment since 2001. This includes active reserve and National Guard forces. The study indicates significant family-related issues from service members who have completed multiple deployments. Active and reserve component forces, as well as National Guard, are all reporting the same operational tempo issues. As a retired Marine Reserve colonel, I saw firsthand with my deployments in Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom the impact significant deployments had on our forces and their families. I have seen very few service members who expressed concern or complained about the operational tempo because that's our style. But it can be observed in the employment and unemployment statistics of veterans versus non-veterans that the problem exists and is growing. At our conference at the White House, some veterans even talked about employer fatigue with the continual deployment of the National Guard and Reserve. The time has come to rethink the Abrams Doctrine and the all-volunteer force. Our nation has stretched the Abrams Doctrine and the all-volunteer force to a breaking point. It has been successful thus far, but only due to the Herculean efforts of our incredibly patriotic military personnel. Our nation and our citizens may be ill-prepared for a major escalation of conflict. The sooner we realize this, the sooner we will be able to deal with such strategic risk to our nation and our way of life. From the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WFAM-AM in Augusta, Georgia, WBXR-AM in Huntsville, Alabama, along with WELP-AM in Greenville, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.